Hello and welcome to I'll Look Into It. I'm your host, Tony Yang. Today we're looking at Asian Americans and social justice. We'll look at the recent history of social justice and activism amongst Asian Americans and why they do not participate. Today we're talking with Dr. Tim Tsang, pastor of Canaan Taiwanese Christian Church in San Jose, California. He's a former associate professor at Graduate Theological Union and has helped host at the Denver Seminary and Colgate Rochester Crozer Divinity School. He's written several books, including Asian American Christianity and Asian American Religious Leadership today. And Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So I want to talk about your article today in Inheritance Magazine about what if Vincent Chin were a Chinese evangelical Christian and how that might have changed. But first, let's talk about the real Vincent Chin and what happened there. So tell me about it.
Well, I'm actually not a Vincent Chin scholar, so I don't know as much about the details. But as far as I know, his death back in 1982 was one which triggered a renewal of interest in civil rights and social justice activism among Asian Americans. And what I've understand about it is that that was the first time that we saw a broad pan-Asian coalition addressing a particular concern and issue. I think prior to that, most of the activism was limited to particular Asian ethnic groups, like the Japanese, what's the word for that? The Japanese American... Well, it was designed to try to seek an apology for the internment camps. I forgot the name of it.
It was the reparation.
The reparation movement. Thank you. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I knew somebody would know better than me.
Well, one of the interesting things I think about, for those of you who don't know about the Vincent Chin case, is that he was a young technical engineer in Detroit who at his bachelor party went to a strip club in Detroit and was attacked and viciously beaten.
That's right.
Outside of that strip club, about 45 minutes later, actually, after he's left the strip club, by two displaced auto workers. And what was the source of the outrage was the short sentences initially given out by the judges, which were manslaughter charges and time served, essentially. Eventually, there was a civil case, about a $2 million judgment that was charged against the two individuals who committed the act. And upon retrial, both men were acquitted of criminal charges. One of the more interesting things about that was is that the fact that the courts, when they made the ruling, there was a sufficient justification about, well, we're angry at Asians because of what was happening in the mm-hmm. Detroit auto industry mm-hmm. at the time, and it kind of continued, and never mind the fact that he was Chinese, not Japanese, but this is where the anger came from. And I think that at some level galvanized the Asian American community, and it gets into that sort of pan-Asian movement mm-hmm. that you're talking about.
That's right.
So what did that pan-Asian movement do?
Well, there were initial protests that were organized in Detroit and other large cities. Chinatown and New York City had rallies. And I think this was the first time on a national stage where the media was able to gain some attention in the media about this particular very brutal slaying. So the activists who organized were largely Chinese and mostly women, but at the same time, many other Asian American activist groups joined in. And I remember, and I am not a historian of this, of the social justice movements, but I do remember growing up at that time, I was active in the American Baptist churches, and in our denomination, there is an Asian American Baptist caucus. And the caucus movement, along with other mainline Protestant churches' caucuses, I recall very, very clearly how the Vincent Chin incident really galvanized them. So they started to work on curriculum and teaching the membership about the importance of racial justice. And I think that really awoke me to the reality of racial justice against Asians in America.
You know, the interesting thing about that, I think, was how Asian Americans are seen by the society at large, and the need for this sort of avocation is because Asian Americans are generally seen as their perpetual outsiders. Mm-hmm. They don't really have a place in American society. I mean, this goes all the way back to the Chinese Exclusion Act. You're mm-hmm. just not viewed as part of American society. So how did the caucus deal with that in the 80s and moving forward?
Well, I think the caucuses and the mainline denominations were very fortunate that the more liberal-leaning denominations and Protestants had already a fairly long and rich history of civil and public engagement. So even before the Civil Rights Movement, mainline Protestants were active in seeking justice, economic or otherwise. So the churches, the Asians that were part of these denominations, inherited the language and theology and the voice. So they felt comfortable talking about that within the denominations that actually were open to listening to them. So I think that helped a lot in terms of getting these caucuses to work together and speak out.
So one of the more interesting things about this was that the bill, this sort of crime occurred before there was any hate crimes legislation that came along much later in the 90s. Do you think that had any effect on it, that this act mm-hmm. occurred in a vacuum of that?
I have no doubt that it had some impact. I'm trying to recall specifically when the hate crime legislations in the 90s occurred. Was that like after?
It was in 94.
94. So 94, if I'm correct. Uprisings in LA. Mm-hmm. So I think that it was an accumulative effect. But I think most of the activists around the Vincent Chin incident were feeling a little bit dispirited by then, but before then, I'm sure this was, it all accumulated.
And so how did, I think, did the church or mm-hmm. even you yourself sort of react yeah. to that? Because, you know, I was born in 1981. Mm-hmm. This is not something that's in my shared historical memory. Like, what was your own personal reaction to it?
Well, I wouldn't have known about it, actually, because I grew up in a church, an immigrant church that was fairly evangelical, and I still identify with it, evangelicalism today. But my dad would not have been aware of what happened to Vincent Chin, and I would suspect that most of the other Chinese evangelical churches were also not very aware of it. Maybe the members were, but the pastors and leaders were not thinking about it. And in fact, that's the reason why I wrote this article. I'm actually a historian of religion in America, and my specialization is the Asian American Christian movement and Chinese Americans in particular. When I wrote this article, I was speculating on that whole issue of why is it that Chinese American evangelicals paid no attention to any of these public or social issues, and what happened with Vincent Chin seemed to have no visible impact on this community at all. In fact, the church in Detroit, the Chinese Bible Church in Detroit, was one of the, it was actually quite an important church, because out of that church, many parachurch organizations, the leadership for parachurch organizations started there. But yet, as I spoke to people who were in that church at the time, no one in that church talked about Vincent Chin at all. There was nothing at all. There was another tiny church that was a Chinese church that's related to the mainline Protestant denomination, I think the United Church of Christ. They actually got out there, and this is a tiny little church, and they supported these rallies and these efforts to try to build a coalition around social justice for Chin, but no one in the Chinese Bible Church, which was a larger church at the time. So that got me started to get me to think more about why our churches don't care, seem to care.
I mean, to kind of go to that point, was it the fact that he went to a strip club that kind of probably really did it? I mean, because it seems like it was difficult. Mm-hmm. I suppose I could imagine maybe this is something endemic in Asian culture and you can speak mm-hmm. to this. Mm-hmm. But to disassociate the fact that, like, he was killed because he was Asian mm-hmm. from the fact that, oh, well, he sinned and therefore right. he deserved what he got.
No one I have spoken to has actually utilized that kind of approach. They haven't said, oh, Vincent was just this, he deserved it because he was such a bad guy. I think that most of it was just simply ignorance and a history and theology of just not feeling the need to engage in any public matters. The primary purposes of most Chinese evangelical churches is just to spread the gospel, grow the churches, and that's it. And that, of course, has consequences which have impacted the lives of the next generation, your generation, for example. But I felt like the main thing was a theology and a social attitude and history of not wanting to engage in anything publicly.
Well, and why is that?
Well, I think among Chinese in particular, the fundamentalist and evangelical movements and the revivalist movements among the Chinese Christians was born out of an anti-public or anti-social justice ethos to begin with. Most of the mainline Protestant Chinese churches back before World War II were very engaged with social justice issues. They were fighting colonialism and things of that nature. But these indigenous Chinese churches were rooted in their own culture on the one hand, but on the other hand, they were also very anti-Western. So anything associated with the liberal churches was considered a Western experience of expression of faith, and they rejected that. So in doing so, they also rejected the Western faith's engagement with social society and social issues. You know, all the colleges in China were started by mainline Protestant or Catholic missionaries. So these groups basically separated themselves from that kind of identity.
I think that's a very interesting aspect. I think maybe you can also speak to this, which is there's a bit of a culture that's mm-hmm. also built into it about not engaging in politics. And that I think is at some level borne out. There's been several articles written about this, about particularly for Asian Americans, mm-hmm. what they're escaping in Asia is usually political turmoil. Mm-hmm. So how you survive political turmoil in Asia is to avoid politics in general.
Yeah. Right? That's one reason. Yeah, I'm sure.
And so maybe you can speak to that about how you've uh-huh. seen that within the church, because mm-hmm. it's kind of very interesting, because you see a lot of, you know, with Hispanics, you know, African Americans, mm-hmm. the church is such a great mm-hmm. strength when it comes to social justice. Mm-hmm. It's not that way for Asian Americans.
No, unless you were part of that generation of Asian Americans in the Protestant liberal mainline churches. Yeah. I think the correlation there is, as you were saying, one is escaping turmoil from Asia. But I think there's also a couple of others. As I mentioned, there's something indigenous about the Chinese church that was anti-Western, anti-social justice, or anti-social engagement. But I think also there's the Cold War angle, too, that many of these Chinese churches were reacting against the Chinese communists. So when they came to America, their primary focus was on being anti-communist and pro-America, because pro-America was the big enemy of communist China.
I think my mom still votes for every Republican candidate, yes, up to this point because of that.
My dad was a Republican, and he, when I started to, when I, my first opportunity to vote, I voted for Ronald Reagan, mostly because of my dad's influence. But even though I knew Jimmy Carter was an evangelical Christian, I still voted for Reagan.
Trump may change that. I think Trump may change my mom's views about that. So, you know, just for the record,
I've come to I've been living in penitence ever since myself. So,
the interesting thing about it is, I think in your article, let's talk a little bit about your article. I think it's a very interesting perspective about what if he had been this Christian, that there would have been a much sort of stronger movement,
yes,
with it, right? So maybe you can tell me about that.
Sure. Honestly, the article is historical fiction. It's speculation. Yeah. But I'm enough of a historian like you are to know that culture and the way that we were raised doesn't necessarily, and even theological and ideological teachings, don't necessarily predetermine how people will behave. Mm-hmm. So I wrote this article with the thought that if Vincent Chin was actually an active or becoming an active Asian American Christian, and maybe even a member of the Detroit Bible Church, Chinese Bible Church, maybe the Chinese evangelical community would have responded differently. And that's what I was basically focusing on the possibility that if he had, he and his family had connections with the Chinese evangelical churches, that that this issue might have spread like wildfire across the entire Chinese evangelical world. And perhaps that would have changed the way Chinese evangelicals position themselves vis-a-vis American society. So in my article, I basically suggested that, oh, yeah, the younger Chinese evangelicals got really excited about this. They wrestled with the idea of whether they should partner with liberal Christians. And when they finally decided to make a public stand, then it just changed everything about the Chinese evangelical church. Of course, that's very speculative, but it was fun to imagine that possibility.
I'd like to remind you that you're listening to Outlook Into It with Tony Yang. Our subject today is talking about, who killed Vincent Chin and what are the consequences, both in the evangelical Asian American community, and what has meant for Asian American social justice. What should Asian Americans do, particularly about social justice, and do about these sort of things? I mean, we are in an era of heightened racial sensitivities and insensitivities, depending on how you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is attacking China, and by extension, I think Chinese Americans. Mm-hmm. We have an investigation at the federal level about Chinese Americans, why they're being targeted for conducting economic espionage simply mm-hmm. because we're highly... we're in positions of capable mm-hmm. being capable of doing it and conducting espionage for China. How do we overcome it? Like, what should we demand as a people? I mean, we're all confused, right?
It's very confusing.
Right. We're the model minority, but we're not, what do we do?
Everyone here probably knows, my primary vocational calling today is as a pastor. And I am a pastor in an evangelical church that's an immigrant church that, for the most part, is not as aware of these issues or doesn't speak of it. So what I need to do within my context and with the folks I'm working with is to try to help bring more awareness of all the things that you've listed.
Issues. I would argue that's what we need in the Asian American community, period. Large,
right. I concur, but I don't feel like I'm an expert in the wider community. You see, this is the thing. Speaking from a religious or Christian perspective, and since my primary connections these days are within that community, I really don't know what the larger Asian American conversation is, what it's like and where is it going. It seems to be going in many places. Asian American studies, I don't know. It feels like to me that it has shifted from a more activist orientation maybe 40 years ago, and now it's become very academic and somewhat disconnected, even though I think there's still the activist bent there. And then you have Asian American activists who speak on so many different levels that it's very hard to determine which ones are the most important. I mean, the anger against microaggression. I don't know.
Well, you're a pastor. Microaggression is kind of something you should probably go, right?
Yeah, I have to, because if I don't, I wouldn't be able to survive. but microaggressions, if that's the main issue to address, I am skeptical about that.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that. Mm-hmm. I think there are still some major structural issues.
Right, right.
And I think
would you consider the Hollywood underrepresentation of Asian Americans a structural issue, or is that considered?
Part of it's a structural issue because they don't, I mean, it's an economic mm-hmm. one, right? Mm-hmm. I would put it in mm-hmm. the terms of you say you can't bank on someone, right? Well, you don't know until you try.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, John Cho, we can mm-hmm. probably bank for something, right? Mm-hmm. For mm-hmm. example. But I think there are broader issues when mm-hmm. you talk about it. The example I always try to use, maybe you can speak into this, about how you deal with the young children and the teenagers in the college group mm-hmm. that you particularly pastor. But the one thing I always say is we are overrepresented. Asian Americans are overrepresented mm-hmm. in the legal field.
Mm.
We do not have an Asian American Supreme Court justice. Everybody right. else has That's had right. one. Although my wife would probably say no, Native Americans don't have one. They mm-hmm. probably should have one first, and I would say yes. but that we are overrepresented in, mm-hmm. in this field, and you know what happens. And Asian Americans are overrepresented in many fields, mm-hmm. but you don't see them as industry leaders.
Right.
We don't see that. And maybe speak to that a little bit, because mm-hmm. I think you have to deal with that in your sure. role as a pastor with a lot of youth who. Mm-hmm. you know, they're like, well, I'm going to aspire to be this. Mm-hmm. And then there may be a crushing reality that sets in.
Yeah, I'm a little bit ambivalent about the bamboo ceiling effect, because it seems like it's so aspirational. Is that we're supposed to be mono minorities, but not really fulfilling the promise of being mono minorities. So we don't have a Supreme Court justice. So I kind of feel a little uncomfortable with that, mostly because I when I look at large swaths of Asian American communities that are extremely poor, mm-hmm. like refugees, the refugee communities, it just sort of makes it feel less exciting to fight that larger battle of making sure we get more Asian Americans in corporate America as CEOs, right? But I see it's still important. It's still an important battle. But I that's why I think the ambivalence is because of that. Mm-hmm. So what I would talk to my kids about our youth group, you see, our church is a fairly affluent church. We're based in Silicon Valley, and the members are engineers, are very highly skilled professionals. So the children don't really have a sense of being oppressed. And we live in the Bay Area and all of California, where Asians are a very large percentage of the population. So we don't really feel like minorities either. Mm-hmm. So I think to get them to be interested in these issues, maybe the bamboo ceiling discussion about why we're not elite is important. We need to start someplace, right? But you know what? You understand my ambivalence.
I totally understand, because there are larger social justice issues. Syria, you know, we have Syrians and people dying all over the place. We have all those sort of issues. But I think it's actually kind of maybe you can speak to this more of a point, and we had discussed this a little bit earlier. Yeah. But it's something I noticed as well, being a college instructor. Mm-hmm. It's just that if you go to the elite universities and you generally are pastoring to more affluent middle income folks, what is the responsibility of that role to speak to social justice? Because I think, you know, as a young college student, I had an awareness, not initially, but certainly by my junior and senior year, that Asian Americans are really overrepresented in these colleges and institutions, and that this is the one time that if we spoke with one voice, we could affect deep change.
Right, right.
And so what is the responsibility of these Asian Americans who are quote-unquote the model minority to the larger society and the social justice conversations moving forward, given this history and legacy? We may have a role in that.
Okay, I'm going to put aside my ambivalence and think about this perspective, because I actually, like you, I kind of got myself into that kind of my experience with working with mainline Protestants and mainline seminaries. I had a taste of that. I think that the biggest challenge is to teach folks who are fortunate enough to get into those arenas to make the distinction between being embedded versus being embedded with. So the temptation, I think, for most of our young people today is to get in bed with the power structures that be, because that's the easiest and the least difficult way to survive and to be rewarded. So that means not thinking about your Asian American identity, not thinking about justice for Asians and other people, and not critiquing the power structures that are in existence today. So it's easy for us to be in bed with, because, you know, we're just at this historic moment where doors are open and we're overrepresented in certain sectors. So I think the trick is in the critical thing is to teach them to be embedded but not in bed with. And that means that even though we're there, we still have to have core convictions that look out for those who are marginalized and in great need of justice. And to me, that's where good theology can address that. Good Christian preaching and teaching in good Christian communities can do that probably far better than communities that are not as organized as Christian communities are.
It's kind of interesting, and maybe you can speak to this and how you guys are trying to address it at your church, but the startling inequality, particularly in Silicon Valley and the Bay Area, because you have the land of plenty, million-dollar homes, and then you have the people who are the janitors and have to drive 2 miles to get to work. You know, how do young people feel about that? How does the church feel about that in particular?
Most of the Chinese churches I know, and I'm mostly familiar with the Chinese churches in the Silicon Valley, the pastors are on board with this idea of trying to get their members more engaged. we do send our young people and families to work among the homeless, to observe and just serve the homeless, and in some cases partner with ministries that are like embedded in very, very impoverished neighborhoods. So for instance, there are some ministries in Oakland, California, which among Southeast Asian refugee populations, that we can partner with. And we've actually sent our young people there. The most difficult part is that after we do this, the time for reflection and engagement, we still haven't figured out how to provide a strategy so our young people can be embedded into this, wherever they wind up going, without being in bed with. And that's our chief struggle. And one of the obstacles to that is the evangelical theology that we've inherited. I'm not suggesting that we should just do away with evangelicalism as a whole, but if there's a way to reform it and make it much more relevant for these situations, then that's I'm all for that.
Well, what things do you think should be reformed?
Well, for one, there's an intellectual construction around evangelical theology that makes it difficult for young people to think that social justice are just engaging the world in that way is part of being a Christian. Mm-hmm. You know, more recently there's been this neo-reformed or neo-Calvinist movement, which basically reproduces double predestination, for example. And when you have a predestinarian approach to theology, it's more often than not can support status quo. Yeah. An elitist
well, and, as well. And just to clarify, predestination means you have very little control over the outcome of your own salvation.
Yeah, God has put you in you're either in or out, and God's done that.
So why does it matter? I tend to be more Arminist, and I think you are too, Tim. It's like, I like to believe that we have some say.
Right, right.
Maybe not complete autonomy, but at least some with that. And that's kind of interesting, because I've seen that effect. It's sort of a very... I would almost say fatalistic approach.
Yeah, it is. It can be.
That's also something very Asian too, about that being very fatalistic about.
But it's fatalist from the elitist perspective, because the preachers who teach this are also highly intellectual. So they have a more intellectual approach to the Bible, and I think the side effect of this is that if you go to a church like that, you feel like you're one of the chosen ones. You're one of the elite. Because I can understand this very sophisticated teaching about the Bible. So I must be one of the saved and chosen to be elite. So the danger there is that it just basically reinforces the aspirational aspects of model minority-ness. So one can just... And if I'm rich, I have a lot of money, then and I care about God, then I'm okay.
And I think, you know, we could talk sometime about the future about attempting to deconstruct that.
Yeah, okay.
Right. But as so frequently with this program, we are all out of time.
No, really?
Yes.
Sorry.
You know, thanks again to Dr. Tim Tsang, pastor of Canaan Taiwanese Christian Church in San Jose, California. You can read his article entitled "What If Vincent Chin Were an Evangelical Christian" in Inheritance Magazine. Our producer is Clark Price. Our engineer has been Elliot Fong. I'm your host, Tony Yang. Tune in next time for more I'll Look Into It. Thank you for listening.